Parshat Ki Tetzé. Tell you a quick story. Can you guess what kind of a story it'll be? So, I think maybe 2 or 3 years into Milavim, we were doing reserve duty in Hebron. And, you know, the first couple days you kind of get to know the ropes. Usually the Mefakdim, the commanders, come to Milavim, come to reserve duty 2-3 days early. We used to go to Beit Jubrin and have this whole kind of get back into the zone, practice the things, the maneuvers that you have to do again, make sure you're back in the space of being an officer, being a commander, whatever. And then we would go to Kav. We would get whatever Kav, whatever line was our line for that month. And the first day that we were on Kav was the last day of the previous unit. So it was just the officers, we would join them, right? And the sergeants. And the men would only come the next day. And we would do a chafifa. We would go around, like, you know, if you're a company commander, you go around with the company commander and you, whatever. So we're going around with the officers that are about to leave. You can smell in the air how excited they are to be done. And we were in Hebron. He shows us different positions. This is a hot spot, whatever. We get to this one tatzpit. It's like an oversight or overlook. It was on a main square called Kikar Gross, which is right on the Kasbah on the Shuk in Hebron. It's named after Aaron Gross, who was murdered in a terrorist attack in the early 80s. And we see that there are these, like imagine a square roof. And there's a little, like, you know, sort of stone wall about waist high around the roof, kind of like you have on our roof. And screwed in are these, like, platot, these tin, corrugated tin, I don't know how to say plata in English, like protective ceilings kind of thing. And I'm looking at this, the whole roof. Like, you can't lean on the wall because these tin things are sticking out. And I'm looking at these pieces of tin, and I understand what they are. And they're sort of metal poles holding them up. So I said to the commander, what is this? So he said, oh, this is nuts. He said, every day, this is a tatzpit, it's on top of an Arab building, in the middle of Hebron, but it's a hot spot, and there are a lot of Jews who come, and they go by, or they used to, and they go into the shuk or whatever, in order to protect them. The army wants a position on top to be able to look out, and to cover them. And every day, in the afternoon, the Arab kids get out of school and they have fun and they throw rocks and they throw bricks and they throw all sorts of things, and sometimes adults join them, and it's really dangerous, and our soldiers were getting hit and injured. We didn't know what to do. So eventually they got the army to put up these, or somebody from the unit put up these corrugated tin like protective devices, and this way when the rocks came flying, the soldiers could roll under the tin and take cover. That's what they said. And all of us, my unit, our mouths opened. And I'm looking at this company commander, and I said, you have to be kidding me. Kids are throwing rocks, that's your solution? Build a system so you can take cover? So he looks at me, he says, wait, you'll see. And it was like one of those questions, like it's doing so many things that day, but it sort of stayed in the back of my head, there's something off here, but okay. So the guys came the next day, we started our kav, sure enough, we put guys up on a tatzpit. That's the best position to be in, because usually there's 6 men, they're put on this tatzpit, on this overlook position, and you kind of leave them, you bring them food, they set their own routine, they set their own guard duties, you know, one of them can always go out, they can plan their own schedule. So guys like this, there's a lot of freedom, a lot of independence, as long as they're doing their job. The commander's kind of seeing, there's one sergeant who's in charge of them, everybody else stays out of their way. So usually you would think, like, people want to be there. And I started hearing that this place is really problematic. And the first afternoon, they got hammered. I mean, you got to imagine, you're standing on a roof, and all of a sudden rocks start flying through the air, bricks and bottles and metal bars. It was ridiculous. And this happened again the second day. The third day, I went to see it for myself. And I saw, there's a school, it wasn't far away. The kids come, that's what you do. If you're an Arab kid who goes to that school, that's what you do. You do your math homework, you do your Arabic, you know, study your history, pick up a rock, go home, throw it at the soldiers, and have lunch. That's just what they do. So I thought that was ridiculous. So we tried everything. We put extra guys on top of the roof, figured if they start throwing, we'd run down and try to catch them. By the time we got down, they were gone. We put lookouts near the school, thinking that as soon as the kids would come out, we would catch them. Right? If you're ever, for some reason, won't be this year to write that, but if you're ever driving near an Arab town, you hear kids whistling, it means that they're signaling each other, something's going on. They see a Jeep coming, they have like a whole system. And you'll hear this, like, for like, you know, long before any Jeep can get there. So we know what to do. So I'm looking at the map, I'm looking at the patrol, I go into the battalion commander, I say, I have an idea. This particular area, sort of the Arab houses go up on the top of the hill, and behind the hill, it falls into a vineyard. There's a whole area of vineyards there. In the back of the hill. So I said, you know, they always see us coming, so we never catch them. We need to catch a few of these kids, right? Take them, or adults, take them to the local station, whatever. Their parents have to pay a fine. They have to pay a fine. Scary to be caught by soldiers, whatever. And that'll calm things down. And if we don't do this now, we're gonna struggle with this for the next 30 days. Who wants that? So they thought it was a good idea. Of course, if you suggest an idea, you end up having to do it. So the next morning, we decided, we woke up early, took two Jeeps, six guys. They popped us like 5-6 kilometers away. And we did a hike. We woke up early, it was like 4, 5, 6 in the morning, and we came up through the vineyard, right? And we planned it to get to the top of the village about 9 or 10 in the morning. By that time, the kids are already in school, right? So they don't know that we're sitting there. And now we're sitting on top of the hill. We're hidden behind a wall, and we're waiting. And as soon as it starts, so we have a radio, and the guy in the tatzpit will be able to see the rocks coming, and they'll let us know, and we'll see if we can catch some kids. Okay. So 5 to 1, school gets out at 1, we get up, and we start walking down the hill and getting close. And sure enough, 1 o'clock, 1:02, kids come out, they start throwing rocks and bars, right? And we're getting directed, and all of a sudden the guy on the roof says, Raul Panim. And the way, Raul Panim, I see a masked man. Now, at that time, this was the first intifada, a Raul Panim means someone who's masked, okay? And you've probably seen pictures of these types of guys. They were very often assassination squads. They were terror squads. And they would, you know, sort of motivate kids to do all sorts of things. These were the guys who came in the night. They would kill people who were, you know, informing or helping the Israelis. They would kill Jews who went through. So this was a whole different level. And, you know, if you caught a Raul Panim, he was taken to court and he was taken to prison and whatever. And if you caught a Raul Panim and he didn't stop, you could shoot. I mean, it was a whole... So all of a sudden he says, you know, there's a Raul Panim. So when you hear that, and we know where he is and we know where we are, and he describes it's two out, he can see us. It's two alleys over from you. So we take off. Right? Take off. I come around the corner and all of a sudden I see, Bemet, there's a Raul Panim. Right? Now we were on a hill. So imagine that there's like sort of levels and I'm up here and down here, maybe 50 yards away, I see a guy. He's got a mask on. He's got a Palestinian flag in one hand and like it looks like a medieval mace. It's like an iron bar with a chain and a spiked ball. You've probably seen pictures of things. And he's swinging it. Now this is a dangerous weapon. And if he lets fly with this thing and hits a soldier, he'll kill somebody, right? So I yell out a scream, right? Waqif, you know, stop, whatever. He sees me. I'm running down, right? He realizes I'm going to catch him. Drops the mace, drops the Palestinian flag, and takes off, right? Now, this is a terrorist. You have a chance to catch someone who could kill somebody. So obviously you take off, and you're running after him. Olympic sprinter, this kid. Unbelievable. He's like running like, I never saw anything like it. And I'm running after him, and I was younger then, but still, you know. And I'm heaving and hoeing and whatever, and trying to catch up with this kid. I see, or whoever it is, this masked man. And I see I'm not getting any closer. And all of a sudden I see he's about to get into a warren of alleyways. And he's going to go through this gateway into more alleys. I'm going to lose him. He's still about 40, 50 feet away, right? So at this point, the orders are clear, right? You can shoot. You have to shoot first at the legs. You have to shoot in the air, whatever it may be, right? So I cock my weapon, shoot it in the air, scream Waqif, and point my gun at him. And he turns around. And I guess he realizes that, I mean, I might not be able to catch him. But, you know, if you think about like half the distance of this room, you're not going to miss, right? So he suddenly realizes that I'm going to kill him. So he throws up his hand. And I get down to him, and I'm heaving and hoeing, right? Like, I can barely breathe. And I jump down. And all of a sudden, I thank God that I didn't fire. Because I pull off his mask, and I couldn't see him, because like he's in a path lower than mine, and there are walls between us. He couldn't even be more than 8 years old. He's a kid. So never mind that I would have killed a kid. Never mind that I would have been in court for who knows how long, defending why I shot a kid, right? It hits me all of a sudden, who is this person? Like I'm running after an 8-year-old and I'm about to shoot him. And it gives you a lot of pause. And forget about, you know, they pick him up and they take him and his father has to come and pay a knas. And the truth is, in the end, we had to pull his father off him. His father wanted to kill him because whatever, but that's another story, right? For Shabbos, right? But it really made me realize, who are we fighting? Is this our enemy? Is this what we're fighting against? You know, put aside what causes an 8-year-old boy to be doing this. Put aside RPG kids used to fire RPGs at us in Beirut. Who is it we're fighting? This week is Parshat Ki Tetzé. This is a powerful parsha. It's a powerful portion. Ki Tetzé L'Milchama L'Oyvecha. Right? Okay? When you go to war. And this parsha, it speaks to what it means to go to war. And I just want to share with you one idea. One thing to think about. Right? It's our first Thursday night. I'd rather, you know, I learned from my wife many years ago, less is more. Just a quick thought. Okay? Ki tetzé l'milchama al oyvecha. When you go to war against your enemies, ask me an obvious question. I'll read it again. Ki tetzé l'milchama al oyvecha. When you go to war against your enemies. What's the obvious question? Yeah. Well, who else do you go to war with? Like, you don't go to war with your friends. The Torah is not usually superfluous. Right? I mean, one of the most fascinating questions that we'll get to talk about this year is, what's the authorship of this amazing book? Is this a divine book? Now, if this is a divine book, and you can imagine my opinion on the matter, if Hashem wrote this or gave this to us, so then obviously, you know, Hashem had eternity to think about what words are going to go in here. There's no extra words. Right? When we speak, we often have extra words. Right? Sometimes you'll hear an Israeli, sometimes it's a tour guide. Right? What does an Israeli say when he doesn't know what he's talking about? What sound does he make? Yeah. Place that we are now, right? What's the English translation of eh? Right. You know, when a person doesn't know what to say, they say regarding Monica Lewinsky, the president, right, doesn't know what to say, right? There's no eh. I'm impressed that you know who that is, but okay, right? There's no eh in the Torah. Hashem doesn't eh. There's just Torah. So what is this doing here? Why? Obviously, if I go to war, I'm going to war against my enemies, right? That makes sense. So what does that mean? Okay? By the way, why does it say, Ki Tetzé L'Milchama? What could it say? Ki Tilachem? When you will fight a war. What does it mean to go out to war? In fact, it's interesting. Rashi here says, you know, there are two types of war. Anybody want to tell me what they are? Mechamet Mitzvah and Mechamet Roshut. Mechamet Mitzvah, according to the Rambam and Hilchot Malachim, Maimonides, is when a nation rises up to destroy you. If a nation wants to destroy you simply because you're Jews, right, there's a mitzvah to do battle, to protect the Jewish people, to fight for the Jewish people, to fight for the state of Israel. That is a Mechamet Mitzvah. I have a very hard time understanding how anybody could think that we're not in a state of Mechamet Mitzvah. I don't understand that. Right? So that's a discussion we'll have another day. Right? Mechamet Rashut, on the other hand, is exactly what it sounds like. It's a war of permissibility. Like, if you want to go, you can go. If you don't want to go, you don't have to go. How do you get drafted? Can you get drafted? In a Mechamet Rashut, if you're scared, you don't have to go. If you just got married, you don't have to go. Mechamet Mitzvah, everybody goes. Even a Kala, from under the chuppah, if you need her, she goes to war too. That's a whole interesting discussion. Right? So, which type of war is this? So what does Rashi here say? Rashi says, "B'milchemet Rishut hakatuv medaber." We're talking about Milchemet Rishut. Now that's interesting. Milchemet Rishut is a war, let's call it a war of expansionism. You know, we want more territory, or they won't sell us oil, and it threatens our existence, so we're going to go take the oil. Put aside for the moment the ethical questions of Milchemet Rishut. That's a very interesting topic. We can talk about that on Shabbat. Right? How does Rashi know it's Milchemet Rishut? Where do I see that it's a Mechamet Rishut? Why would I say it's not a Mechamet Mitzvah? You want to say it? Yeah?
Just a thought. It says when you go out to war, implying some sort of that they chose to go to war.
Oh. Okay, so you're connecting the dots. Very impressive. Okay. Remind me your name?
Daniel.
Okay, the Daniel Dicker Rebbe. Very good. Okay. You know what that means, by the way? You have to say Shonabet. That's it. It's all over, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now you can send this to your parents, right? Okay. Right. So listen to what the Sforno says. Ki Tetzé. Why does it say Ki Tetzé? It means you're going out. Where are you going out? Chutz La'aretz. If you're going to fight a war outside the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, that's not Mechamet Mitzvah Pshat. Okay. I think it can be deeper. I want to understand what it means to go out to war. What it means to fight a war. So listen to the Orach Chaim. Okay? Listen to the Orach Chaim. The Orach Chaim says like this. By the way, the Orach Chaim, Rav Chaim ibn Attar, one of the greatest rabbis of the last 500 years, not that many rabbis make the page of the Mikraos Gedolos of this sort of traditional collection of commentaries that we all have. Orach Chaim was one of them. What's amazing about the Orach Chaim is that he lived right up the street. Anybody know what street he lived on? Orach Chaim Street, okay? That's the street you take when you're going the right way and not getting into trouble walking through the shuk from Shar Yafo. You can actually see the house where the Orach Chaim lived. You can actually see the house where the Orach Chaim wrote his perush. In fact, it took him 5 years to write his perush on Torah. Anybody want to guess why? Right? Every year he put out a different sefer. There's a legend about him that he never left his house. They brought him meals. There was a minyan in his house while he wrote this. There's another legend that says that he wrote the entire commentary on ritual purity. If he even touched his hair, he went to mikvah. If he went to the bathroom, he went to mikvah. Right? And when you study his Torah, you feel like it's pure. Of course, the historians used to laugh about this. Like, okay, he never left his house, but he always went to mikvah. Must have had a mikvah in his house. Right? They always used to laugh at this until after the Six-Day War, when courtesy of a Jordanian artillery shell, they actually found a mikvah on the roof of his house. And you can actually see it. If you ever go there on a Shabbos morning, you can daven, when you're not with yeshiva, like on a different Shabbos, go to the Orach Chaim shul, and you can see the mikvah of the Orach Chaim behind glass. Anyway, listen to what the Orach Chaim says, okay? Lama utzrach, tzrach al dat, lama utzrach lomar kol zeh. Why do we need all this? And you go to war against your enemies. You ready for this? Right? If it tells me I'm going to war, it doesn't even tell me we're going against our enemies. That's obvious. So listen to this. Leze ba katuv v'itne v'amar ki teitze tiyeh yitziyatcha lemilchama linakem mo'ivecha shem mo'ivei Hashem. You know, and the other Mefarshim talk about this as well. There's certain things that become permitted in war. They're not ideal. They're not lachatchila. They're not what you should do. But there's a reality. There's an understanding that when a person fights a war, sometimes your yitzarim, your tavot, your lust, whatever it be, they grow so strong, you break boundaries. It's a very challenging reality to be in. And it doesn't have to be as extreme as Eishet Yifat Torah, which we'll talk about on Shabbat, take captives and all sorts of things. Mildly. I remember once we were coming back from Lebanon. We used to be in the army for 17 days and then get out for 4. And getting out was a very intense experience because it was obviously very dangerous. And they would take you on these safari trucks and you had to go with all your gear. You couldn't, today a soldier in Israel gets out. He comes out just a uniform, right? In his bag, maybe a gun. But in order to get out from Shabbos from Lebanon, from your mutzav, so you had to get on the safari truck and you had to be, take cover and whatever. And eventually in armored personnel carriers. So you would have your shachbats, your flak vest, and your gear, and all the whatever, and your helmet. And then, you'd sort of get to whatever, and you had to take it with you. You could always tell when the guy was coming down from Lebanon, because he was the guy with the helmet and the gear and all the whatever. It was cool, but it was a pain, whatever, right? And I remember one time we get off the safari trucks, we're walking into Kiryat Shmoneh, we're going to catch a bus back to civilization. And a couple guys had to, do a geschäft. So, when you're out on patrol in Lebanon, there's no bathroom, you don't wait to get to the men's room. Your men's room is this tree or that bush. Okay, so they'd been doing that for 2.5 weeks. So a couple of guys had to do a winkle. So they walk off on the side of the street. And what are you doing? Guys, we're in Kiryat Shmona. This is not Lebanon. Wait till you get to the bathroom. Because you forget. Sometimes a person looks at that. There's something about being in situations like that. You get to put aside your boundaries. So maybe a person goes to war for the wrong reasons. Sometimes a guy joins the army, it's cool. You get a pair of paratrooper wings. You get to wear a red beret. It's not the reason to go to the army. Why do you go to the army? You go to the army, ki tetzel melchama al oivecha. You have to know what it is you're fighting for. Let me tell you the best example I can think of. Okay? David HaMelech. Remember the story of David and Goliath? It's an unbelievable story. Right? David... David comes to the battlefield. Goliath is this 8-foot-plus giant. They're terrified of him. Every day he comes into the valley in Emek Ha'ilah, which is about 35 miles from here. Maybe someday on a Friday I'll take you there. I can show you exactly where this battle was fought. They actually found archaeological evidence. We know where the Philistines were. We know where the Jews were. And David comes, and he can't believe that nobody's going to fight this guy. And he says to Shaul, to the king, you know, let me go fight him. And Shaul wants him to take armor. He doesn't want to take armor. And he goes down to the valley, and there's this moment. Now you got to picture it. There, from various things that the Tanakh tells us, we know that David was not a big guy. He was a little bit of a short guy. In fact, when Hashem tells Shmuel to anoint him, Shmuel can't believe this is the guy who's going to be king, because like he's a little nachni, right? He's a red-headed nachnach, right? But it's David. So David comes down into the valley. What does Goliath say, right? He says, give me a second. Vayomar plishti ala David. So the plishti, the Philistine, Goliath says to David, Hakelev anochi, am I a dog? Ki ata ba'elai b'maklot. You come to me with your slings, with your sticks, are you serious? Come over here. Come over here, l'chai elai, ve'etnad b'sachal l'of ha-shamayim. I'll feed your carcass to the birds. So what does David HaMelech say? Says David HaMelech, v'yomer David l'apishti, ata ba'i elai b'cherev, u'b'chanit u'b'chidon. You come to me with a sword, with a spear. V'anuchi ba'i lecha b'shem Hashem tzvakot, elokei ma'achot Yisrael ha-shecherafta. I come to you in the name of God. You don't have a chance. Because I'm fighting for something that's so much bigger than you. You have to know what it is you're fighting for, and you have to know who you're fighting. Ki teitse l'milchama al oyvecha. You don't fight a war if you don't know who your enemy is. You have to know who your enemy is. You know, it's become confusing today. You see a kid and he's flying a kite. And it's like a peaceful afternoon. And you figure, you know, what a beautiful scene. And then you see that he's attaching something to the kite. And it's some incendiary device or flammable material. And you're an Israeli soldier. And you have a sniper scope. And he's about to fly a kite with a Molotov cocktail attached to it. Or an incendiary device or a bomb. What do you do? It's not a simple question. On the one hand, he's a kid. Can you really blame an 8-year-old? He's indoctrinated. He's brainwashed. On the other hand, are you going to go sit with the parents of the family who paid the price for you having mercy on that kid? Who's your enemy? What is it you're fighting for? Difficult questions. And I'll go you one deeper. Because in addition to it being confusing who our enemies are, Rabbeinu Bachya takes it one step deeper. Include this? Rabbeinu Bachya makes the point that this is all a mashal. Eshet Yefat Torah, you know, taking a beautiful captive, all the mashal. What is the war that we're really fighting? You know, we always read this in the Shabbos of Elul. This is always the period leading up to Rosh Hashanah. The first question is, are you prepared to go out? You know, war is a tough thing. And one of the most difficult things about war is that it forces you to leave your comfort zone. You know? And it's not the obvious things. Like, you know, it's obvious that a person can be scared. And bullets are flying around. But you know what I found to be the absolute most difficult aspect of war? Bar none. It was the exhaustion. It's hard to describe what it's like to have to function after 2 or 3 days of no sleep. And you finally have a chance to put your head down, and there's some other mission, and you can't keep your eyes open, but you have to. The depression that falls on you is beyond description. It's unbelievable how difficult it is to motivate yourself, and how much you rely on the people that surround you. You know what they call a unit in Hebrew? Anybody know? A yechida, from the word echad. They break you down and they turn you into one. You become one. And you learn to rely on each other. You know? I think that this is true for all the battles that we fight. You know? You get ready for another year. And you have to ask yourself first, what's your battle? What is it that we have to fight? It doesn't have to be so glamorous as putting on a uniform and going up to Lebanon. It could be something simple like dealing with anger, overcoming laziness, beating an addiction, anything. The first question is, have I defined what my battle is? Do I know what I'm fighting? Do I know what my enemy is? Because you know we are our own greatest enemies. The second question is, am I willing to go to war? It's a battle. You know? I don't know. Let's say a person wants to lose weight. Well, the reason the person has to lose weight is because he's got a yetzer. He's got a desire. And he has difficulty to some degree with self-control, maybe. Sometimes a person has to lose weight for medical reasons. He takes medication. I'm not talking about that. So let's say you've defined something that you want to fight against and for, and you've defined what it is that's causing you to have this battle. Are you prepared to go out of your comfort zone? Right? Could be anything. And if you are, ki tetzei l'milchama, if you're ready to step outside your comfort zone and go to war, right? Do you know why it is that you're doing this? If you're losing weight so that when you go into the Rover Square, the Baba Basra girl can check out your Baba Kama, so that's not why you lose weight. That's nonsense. If you're losing weight because you believe that you need to be in balance, you need to be healthy, so you can serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's unbelievable. And that's true with everything. And I just want to end by saying, that's what this year is. We go into Rosh Hashanah every year. And sometimes it gets you down. You feel like you're fighting the same battle again and again. You know, this week's Parsha, fascinating. One of the things that I find that is a shocker to some people, right, is actually an issue that comes up within this week's Parsha. V'nishmarta mikol davara, as the Pasuk says, in Dvarim Perkhov Gimel Pasuk here, 23:10. And the Medrash in Vayikra Rabbah says, you know what this is talking about? Protect yourself from all evil things. Want to take a guess? What is something worth working on? Foul language, nivul peh. Interesting. In the middle of this parsha about war, the Medrash says, you got to fight the urge to say things that you don't want to say. So how do we do these battles? How do we win these battles? How do we overcome ourselves? The first stage is stepping out of our comfort zone, recognizing that there's something worth fighting for, thinking about the implications of what it is that we fight for, right? And then I guess the challenge will be to come up with a system to do it. So we're still early. We have a whole year to think about these things. Something to go into Shabbat with. What are the battles that I want to take on? What are the struggles that I'm willing to struggle with? And who is the unit that I'm with who can help me in the challenges that I have? Something to think about as we go into Shabbat, Parshat Ki Tetzei. There's a lot more to talk about. I think we'll call it a pause here, right? Let me just... Hang on. Let me just...